you've raised it. And I'd forgotten how surprising that is.
Ban the wearing of abayas in school.
The way that women are used, if we are very good to look at, then we are stripped of our dignity.
Today, you've got teachers who see it as their duty to proselytize, to convert Muslim kids.
That event was where the first time I'd really experienced segregation of the genders. Being a thinking person by the grace of Allah, I thought to myself, oh my God, I think I'm a misogynist.
It's no exaggeration to say that in their quest to malign Islam, some in the West target Muslim women. Her position within the family, her place in society, and of course her dress are placed under the microscope. And like colonialists in the days of empire, her emancipation is seen to be a means to a greater Islamic reformation. In recent days, France's Minister of Education has announced that abayas, the loose dress many Muslims wear for modesty, will be banned from schools. Apparently, a piece of clothing is an affront to French secularism, and yet again, another sign of separatism. In the UK, former Prime Minister Boris Johnson likened burqa-wearing Muslim women as those that chose to look like letterboxes and bank robbers. Young Muslim women are subject to a barrage of what can only be called propaganda, traducing their religious dress and promising to liberate them from their religion. Now, to help us understand how this works and to caution against some of the extremes by which the community can handle this onslaught, I am delighted here on The Thinking Muslim to invite the writer and activist Lauren Booth. Lauren Booth is a broadcaster turned activist and author. She is known for her principled activism on Palestine and regularly comments on Muslim affairs. And she is also the author of this memoir, In Search of the Holy Land, which is available on Amazon and all good bookshops, I think. In fact, Lauren, I'm amazed that you've got a recommendation here from Nikki Campbell, a fascinating read. I couldn't put it down. I mean, Nikki Campbell often is characterized as someone who doesn't really have a good word to say about Islam and Muslim women. How did you get that?
Assalamu alaikum, rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thanks very much for inviting me. I've wanted to come on the Thinking Muslim podcast for quite a number of years now. I really enjoy your content and your interview.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Interviews. Nikki Campbell, yeah, that was, you've raised it. And I'd forgotten how surprising that is and how it started. So about 5 years ago, we were having a spat on Twitter because he had said something so obnoxious that I just had to really pull him up about it. We'd worked together previously, Radio 5. We'd got on well in my former incarnation as a non-Muslim broadcaster.
And what did he say?
He said on Twitter, right, he said, it was about the burqa not being allowed in France. And it was, you know, really, we knew that a ban towards hijab, ban towards the veil, all of these things were coming up in France. And he said, I would rather my 15-year-old daughter went mostly nude on a beach that she covered up like that. And I'm sure he used something like a letterbox, or, but it was really obnoxious. And so a lot of Muslims underneath had commented, and I just put out on my feed, look, that is out of order. It's a disgraceful thing to say. It's awful on your daughter. It's Islamophobic. It causes all kinds of problems. You have no idea about this, and you actually have no right to put your foot into this. And I said, everybody who agrees with me, bombard Nikki Campbell right now. Within the hour, his Twitter feed had almost crashed with furious Muslims just, you know, really going at it and saying, take this down, take this down. So he got in touch with me in the DMs and he said, Lauren, I'm being harassed online because of you. I said, no, Nikki, you're being harassed online because of your obnoxious views. He said, okay, that's as may be. Could you call off your attack dogs? I said, don't call my people dogs.
Yeah.
And, but what I might do, oh no, then he said something. He said, I thought Islam was about being polite. And I'm like, oh, damn. He's pulled the be nice card and what would the prophet do?
Yes.
So I said, you know what? If you're feeling harassed, I will ask people to tone it down. But you and I need to talk. So we got into a discussion and I tried to make him see, talked about the hijab, and he asked some really good questions. He said, can you advise me? And it led to when my book came out, I said, Nikki, I feel you should read this. As a friend, we've come to a kind of a very warm impasse. And I'd like to send it to you. And he read it and I said, he loved it. And I said, I'm going to use your review on the front. Is that okay? He said, Lauren, go for it.
Wow.
So it just shows that people don't like to think of themselves. Nobody wakes up in the morning and goes, you know what? I'm really going to annoy people today. I'm really going to pour hatred out there. Not if they're in any way ethically, morally not bankrupt. And they have half a mind, you know, for what words mean. They want to be talked around. So let's engage. That's my message.
Now, I provocatively use the word onslaught against the Muslim women or against womanhood in my introduction. And I suspect many may dispute this as hyperbole. How do you assess the current discourse surrounding Muslim women?
Well, I look at, first and foremost, we use our own experiences as jumping off points. And I know for certain that there are arenas where I am and my views, legitimate, well-informed, journalistic views, have no space anymore because I dress as a Muslim.
Really?
Yeah. So I used to work part-time for the BBC. I used to do reports on Sky News. I mean, the newspaper reviews, etc.
Yeah.
And when I put on the hijab, that ended overnight.
Oh.
That's not a coincidence. And that is the experience, more importantly,
yeah,
of women across Europe.
Really?
There is something that the European Union and their the parliament there in a report has accepted and acknowledged. It's called the triple bind. So if you're a Muslim woman in Europe, you've got your degree and you want to go into the workplace, you have these three factors against you. One, you're a woman anyway. Two, you're in hijab. And three, if you have a Muslim name. And that means that that's three, pretty much three strikes and you're out. And that is a real difficulty. It's a real prejudice. And that's what we've been facing for a long time.
Recently, we're talking in a week where the French Ministry of Education has banned the abayas in schools, or banned the wearing of abayas in school. And that follows, you know, a series of bans, the ban of the face veil in France and on streets as a fine for someone who was a face veil. In fact, I remember they even passed a law which prohibited Muslim women from asking for a female doctor. Potentially, they would get a fine if they requested a female doctor. So there is this obsession. And of course, in France, there's a ban on the hijab as well in public buildings. So there is this obsession with women's dress in France and across Europe. What lies behind this obsession?
You know what? I'm going to agree with that, but I'm actually going to extend it to a socially unwell society.
Right.
Because I was on a plane yesterday coming from Istanbul. We were waiting for our plane, actually. Everything had been backed up. And I got into a conversation with a woman who lives in France, and she said, and I was saying exactly what you're saying, what is this obsession with women's dress? She said, hey, it goes deeper than that. Her friend had taken her six-year-old son to a swimming pool, and he had long shorts on.
Yeah.
And they said, no, you can't come in.
Wow.
Why not? Because you have to wear Speedos. And she said, are you seriously saying that my six-year-old should be in budgie smugglers?
Yes.
Don't even think about what that means.
Yeah.
And that's an obsession with a sexualization of the human body.
Yeah.
And a minimal amount of dress so that everybody is accessible to everyone else. So on the one hand, if you're French, if you're Muslim and you're living in France, you know it's about being Muslim. But if you're a French person who wants a different level of modesty, you also know that there is a catchment area where you are different from the rest of the society. Mm. So there's a sickness that really causes that society to focus on the Muslims there, but it goes deep into every arena. I mean, to me, France is a failed state. It's a failing culture. When you actually have to put a gun to a woman who is modestly dressed on a beach and tell her, take your clothes off, you've lost your mind. And when you're telling children, little boys, you can only wear a strip of material like this or not come swimming, you are really in an unhealthy situation.
Now, the online space and generally popular culture is a very confusing place, I think, for Muslim girls or young Muslim women in particular. You know, I've got a daughter, and I think that unlike maybe my son, she is impacted by a barrage of confusing messages about her Muslimness, about hijab, about the obligations of wearing certain types of dress. And it just seems to me that there is this deliberate attempt to target Muslim girls in particular and to, dare I say, to try to make them move off the path of Islam. I mean, am I exaggerating this? What's your perspective on this matter?
Can I ask how old your daughter is?
She's now 20.
She's 20 now.
Yeah.
So she's made her decisions, but all of that time, probably from the age of about 8, she will have been really hyper aware of being different in the public space,
very
different
much.
At school,
yeah.
Spoken about, not spoken to,
yeah.
Othered. All of those things are really dynamic and drive a lot of girls into saying, I can't do this. Most mothers of Muslim girls, say in the UK right now specifically, they will meet a point when one of their daughters will say to them in hijab, perhaps at 13, I don't know if I can do it tomorrow.
Mm.
I just want a day off. And at that point, you realize that society is social engineering the Muslim community by criminalizing the young men. There are more new laws in the last 20 years focusing on young Muslim men and Muslim areas to make men less successful, boys less successful. You know, Muslims are dire in education. And yet we can get 34, a 16-year-old Muslim girl got 34 GCSEs at A. Mm. And the young men, you know, don't worry about them. Let them fail. The pots of gold that go to Birmingham are for secularized Muslim women's groups, by the way.
Yeah.
So you have that big draw. If I want to be successful, the Muslim women's groups that the government likes are all led by non-hijabi women. And are not diverse. Mm. And we've been saying this for a long time. Come on, let us be represented even in our own communities. So I would say, actually, brother, it's gone so far into making us insecure that you're beginning to see workspaces run by Muslims. And I've had this specifically with a convert sister who was sacked. Or no, she was told by the Asian men she worked for, who were Muslims, don't wear black all the time. It really puts off the customers.
Mm.
She's a convert to Islam, trying to be modest in her way and learning her faith.
Yes.
Told by Muslim bosses, the way you look is putting off white customers.
Right.
I mean, where do you go with that?
Right. And why? Why? I mean, you're intimating that there is an atmosphere that has been created, deliberately created, to shoehorned to push Muslim women in a particular direction. I mean, can you speak to that? Why is this atmosphere being created?
I think it's clearly an insecurity in our society about the strength of what our culture is. And when I say our, I say all of us as British people, right? You know, when you go abroad and you're like, well, what is Britishness?
Yeah.
This has been something the Conservatives have wanted to ask us for the last 20 years. What does it mean doing British? There's been lots of jokes about it. I mean, for me, when I was 20, you know what it meant? It meant ska music, bacon sandwiches, Aouzou Billah, and Notting Hill Carnival.
Right.
That was Britishness. Now, to my grandparents, that would be, apart from the bacon sandwiches, an absolute anathema, right?
Yes.
So that what is being British doesn't allow yet for a diversity of experiences.
Yeah.
And that's making everybody insecure. I mean, you've got Rishi Sunak, who has agreed to have an immigrant holding ship on the Thames in order to go along this anti-diversity, this fear of foreigners movement. I mean, that really speaks to an insecure environment, doesn't it?
Yeah. Let me ask you about the hijab in particular, because of course, back to, you know, my daughter, I mean, when she was growing up, she had conflicting messages from everywhere about the hijab, to the degree that you had what seemed like people who were being very much sponsored by central government, or at least sponsored by NGOs that were linked to central government, discouraging her from wearing the hijab. There's a lot of noise out there about what is the appropriate, what is the correct Muslim dress. Now, of course, I know that some Muslim women find it very difficult to wear the hijab. And, you know, that's not what I'm speaking to here. But I also know that there is just general confusion that probably has never been in Islamic history. I suspect in most of Islamic history, Muslim women generally knew, okay, this is the requirements of Islamic dress. How does a Muslim girl navigate this noise that seems to be out there, which is discouraging her from worshipping Allah?
So first thing we have to do is to really look at who we are following. So each of us has our own individual timeline. Have you ever been shown, somebody in your family has said, oh, here's my Instagram feed. And you're like, that is weird. What is that? It's like going into somewhere really strange. Sometimes my husband will log in to his account for some reason on my laptop, and I'll end up going through his feed for half an hour going, why is it in Arabic? Why is it so weird? And go, oh, God, I'm literally trolling my husband. It's so different. So their worlds are very, very different. So number one, you have to look at who are you following? Is it hyper-sensualized pop stars? Is it jokers on Instagram? Is it women who cover? And where are you taking your faith from? So none of us can legitimately say that we're going to be, as women, taking our faith from a woman who looks like she's in the Barbie film. All right? That would be like, okay. Harun Yahya tried it a few years ago.
Yes.
That strange cult leader in Turkey.
Yes.
He surrounded himself with blonde women, hyper-sexualized, and said, this is the deen. And everyone went, yeah.
Yes.
You've lost your mind.
Yes.
So if you're a young woman and you're saying, right, on the one hand, I might like this pop music and I like these shows on Netflix and that, right? That's just social culture. But when you come to the deen, you're not going to go to Netflix. Right? Because you know that's outside our deen. So when you put in, here's a little thing you can try. I'm saying this straight to your daughter and young women out there. Put into Google female Muslim scholar.
Mm.
Not influencer, not celebrity or personality. Okay? We're talking about people who teach the actual deep and the basics, the building blocks of our Islamic deen.
Yeah.
None of them will be uncovered. Now, if these women know the prophetic model and the Quranic model of expectations, and they're paid and endorsed to teach this by the ummah, by the ulama, then surely that's enough for me. I'm a very simple person. I have to be honest. Mm. I don't need complexities. Mm. I do something simple like that. And I say, you know, your dean, you're teaching me and you're all covered. Then that tells me all I need to know.
Great. Yeah. That's a very, very good sound piece of advice, I think. There is an argument or a discussion that seems to have gained currency in recent months and maybe even recent years about reinterpreting the Islamic text according to modern standards. And one such strand of discussion is that maybe some of the Sahaba, Ridwan Allah alayhi, may Allah reward them immensely for their efforts and their struggles, maybe some of the Sahaba had, in inverted commas, a misogynistic mindset. And so when they conveyed hadith, they conveniently conveyed some hadith which would today be regarded as misogynistic. For example, I don't know, hadith that places, you know, the man's responsibility to be at the head of the household, for example.
Is that misogynistic or is that common sense?
Well,
call that misogynistic.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, I remember there was a Twitter, and again, Twitter isn't the real world. And I think that's what you said in the previous answer. But yeah. In one Twitter discussion, there was some discussion about Abu Huraira radiallahu anhu being someone who was, you know, misogynistic in the sense that he conveyed some hadith which the particular person disliked. I mean, how would you address this sort of reinterpreting Islam from the modern lens?
Look, the first thing to note is there has definitely been a deliberate collaboration of a certain type of hadith telling people how to behave in interpersonal relationships between men and women. Mm. And it's Salafi publishing. Mm. And it has been very successful in the last 35 years in telling us one version, one very harsh, basically unlivable, I would say, to a degree, version of what it is to be a man and a woman in a marriage, a marital and a housing relation, you know, a family relationship. Yeah. So there's been that editing. Most of us don't have the Arabic, the fiqh, the Sharia knowledge to delve into these matters. Mm. Who would I be right now to give my, even if I praised it with, in my humble opinion, on these very deep matters? I follow teachers. And each one of us, each of us needs to find a teacher. Mm. And above all, our connection to Allah Ta'ala, our prayers, our salah, our dhikr, this is our connection to the truth of the deen. Mm. Going and doing some search and saying it's all rubbish because I've seen the light. I had a man come up to me, funnily enough, a lot happened in the last 2 days at Istanbul Airport, apparently. Yeah. He came up to me and he said, you're a convert to Islam. I know some truths about the Quran. And I said, I said, where are you from? He said, I'm Iraqi. I said, are you a sheikh? He said, well, it depends what you mean by sheikh. I said, well, a sheikh is someone who learned from someone who learned from someone who learned from someone who learned from the prophet, peace be upon him. He said, I know more than them. I said, then you're very arrogant.
Yes.
He said, well, I'm walking away from this. I said, please do. Yes. Right? So I think we need humility and I think we need guides.
What do you think about the current? I know you live in Istanbul and maybe you've been immune to what's been going on in the West in the last probably couple of years. And it's a discussion about womanhood and discuss about gender and it's discussion about trans women and their status in society. And again, that's one of the complexities that we've found we've had to navigate around as Muslim parents, as just Muslims in this community. Like how, you know, of course, we are minorities and we have to somewhat navigate lots of complexities and challenges. And as you, I think, said in an earlier answer, it takes a lot of bandwidth to be a Muslim in the West. There's so much on the road and you've got to just think about lots of things. But anyway, this issue about womanhood has come along and it's a difficult subject to broach. I mean, how would you approach what's going on here in the West in recent years?
You know what? First of all, I'd like to say I'm still a journalist and I'm married to a journalist. So if only we were out of this awful, you know, the stuff that you're hearing, the question being asked, what is a woman? And people saying, well, it's someone who thinks that they might be and can be, if they choose, would be to wear, no, not to wear, but, you know, adult female human is quite a simple answer to come to, really. We're looking at the erasure of women. There's no doubt about
it. The erasure of women.
The erasure of
women. That's quite a hard statement. You know, explain that. What do you mean?
Okay, well, I'm going to go back to the fact that, first of all, let's start with women who are aging, all right? I've worked in TV for 30 years now. And since the last 20 years, a host of TV presenters from the BBC have complained about this. Female presenters over the age of 40 saying, hang on, I was the head of three current affairs show. Suddenly I was ditched. And the BBC has had to pay out record damages to a number of women because this society, not the Muslim society, but this secular society judges women based on their appeal. I just got off a plane. How many times am I mentioning planes today? I think I'm still in the airport.
Yeah. For our viewers, you were stuck in Istanbul Airport for 2 days, was it?
2 days, yeah.
Yes.
It obviously had an impact on me, but I was the way that women are used. If we are very good to look at, then we are stripped of our dignity and put on posters next to a water bottle going, buy this, it's pure, you know, and it's filthy and it's horrible. And I had to look for, like, you know, 4 hours at this. And eventually I took it out, it was on the seat back, and just turned it round. And there was a man sitting next to me. I said, do you mind if I just take that out and turn it round? Because I did not want to look at a naked woman. So we're very visual as women in British society, in European society, if we're attractive and near naked. If you're aging, you can feel already redundant, ignored. I live in Istanbul. The women there are increasingly having duck lips, terrible amounts of Botox. They're looking ill. And so, along with asking what is a woman, how should we look is an obsession to everybody in the society.
Right.
And so when we have the guts and the serenity and the sheer unbridled guts to say, I'm not showing you anything today. Oh, yeah, and you won't be seeing me tomorrow either. You're just going to get my face. And what I say, that is such a powerful statement.
Right. So your argument is that the hijab, in a way, it liberates women in a sense, but it makes them into less of a sex object, someone that should be admired for their beauty and that's it, to someone who one needs to engage with on an intelligent level. But again, the counter argument to that by many in the West would be, well, where does that exist? I mean, you live in Istanbul. Are women in hijab treated, you know, in that way, that idealistic way that you present?
Well, hang
Islam?
On a second. I'll give you a couple of examples. I lived in Qatar in 2015.
Yes.
And the first time I went there, I remember being, you go to the airport and there's the woman's line. And I was taken out by the soldier and he goes, or the customs officer, he goes, oh, over here, madam. And there's nobody there. And I walk through like royalty and I'm like, okay. And all the men are queuing over there.
Yeah.
And then I go shopping and I have my bags picked up and carried to the car.
Yes.
And even now I went to Qatar for the World Cup. And my husband, who's a lovely man, by the way, he always complains that when we go to Qatar, I expect to be treated like a queen afterwards, because I see the women in the airport and they're just wafting along in black, you know, and their husbands or their sons or other people are carrying things. And my husband, he carries most things, but I still carry something. And I'm like, take my bag, you know, because it elevates us and gives us a break. I there is a lot of beauty out there. Does this happen all the time in Turkey? No. But you know what? Hijabis have a superpower.
Right.
We have a superpower. I was told this by by Albanian girls who don't wear hijab.
Mm.
They said, you know what? When we see you in the street, it's like you're gliding along and it's like you're surrounded by light and you have a superpower.
Mm.
And so as a hijabi wearing woman, you have that extra meter of space. You're either beautifully invisible, because it's quite nice to be invisible in the street, or you're just, you know, you're left alone. Men don't press against you. Men stay back a bit. And that's a nice experience, because I've had the other one.
Right.
I've been the woman in the shorter. There was a BBC presenter who came to visit me after I accepted Islam.
Yeah.
She said, I can't believe you're the same Lauren I met at the election party 8 years ago. I said, oh, whatever I said, I'm sorry. Mm. She said, I would describe you as the woman with the biggest mouth in the shorter skirt. I went, yeah, that would have been me, right? And no body space, no respect from the men. It's very different in hijab. Mashallah. It's a bonus.
So you live in Istanbul, and anecdotally, it seems to me that more and more Muslims have decided to leave the West and to move to Muslim countries like Qatar or to Kuwait or to Istanbul. I think in Istanbul, we've seen, you know, last time I was there, I saw a growth in a number of Westerners, Western Muslims who've decided to live there. And most of them say they just had enough of the criticisms they get in the West. They've had enough of the racism maybe they get, or the Islamophobia, but also they fear for their kids. Mm. It's now common for Muslims here to think about, if not move into a different country, to think about pulling their kids out of school. I mean, where do you stand on this discussion about how intense it's become in education and just general society towards Muslims?
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You know what? It's really interesting. For 10 years, a friend of mine called Anissa, she's an educator, mashallah. She has been raising the alert, going, you don't know what's in the books.
Really?
She's been on these education groups that I'm on. She's like, mums, wake up. Ask to see the books on your kids' curriculum. What age? Not 11, not 10, 7 and 8. Mm. Ask to see them. Mm. And when you ask to see them, the teachers say you don't need to. Or now, increasingly, you can't see them in case you protest. Because it is such disgusting content in children's books at schools that they cannot show it on the news. The same nightly news that shows dead bodies and bombs falling and explosions and horrendous things going on cannot show the books that are being given to our 4- and 5-year-olds. Interestingly, this is a sign of a failing society. There was a study done in 1936 by a British academic, and he found the same trigger points for each failed civilization that he studied.
Really?
Yes, rise in androgyny, not liberation of women, I forget the word, but it's basically no protection of the women, right? And the sexualization of society, a rise in homosexuality, all of these things are happening. It's a dire situation, and I totally understand Muslim families wanting to leave. It is. I thought about 10 years ago, actually, brother, that, and I still do, that if you really wanted to get the Muslims out of Europe,
yeah,
and you couldn't kill them like the French did with the Algerians just 30 years ago and then threw their bodies, or 40 years ago, threw them in the Seine, a'udhu billah, that what you do is you just make it a little bit unlivable. A little bit unlivable. Let's say in France, you can't have halal meat at school. What is that? No halal meat. You have to eat pork if you're at school or go without. What if we, oh, I know, they don't like sex with outside marriage, the Muslims. How about we talk about that all the time? And how about we force, we say to their children, homosexuality is an option, and we do that at a young age. That is kind of social engineering. Now, I'm not saying this only affects the Muslim community. We're not paranoid. This is a devaluation of the human spirit across the spectrum. But it really is helping us leave. And I think it's a good leave. I think it's a good thing.
Really?
I think we should leave the sinking ship, and we should be building up our countries and offering an alternative, which is what the Ottoman and the Al-Andalusian societies did, was say, hey, come over here. We've got beauty here. We've got fairness here. We've got a way that you can move up the ranks in society. You're not trapped. And for that reason, hundreds of thousands, millions perhaps of Christians came and lived in our Muslim communities, and the Jewish community thrived for centuries there.
I used to be an educator, and I know that 20 years of the war on terror has in a way radicalized the teaching profession. And today you've got teachers who see it as their duty to proselytize, to convert Muslim kids into good little liberals or something like that. This type of fear, I think, that Muslims face in this society is very palpable. Now, not everyone's going to be able to leave the country. We've got, 2-3 million Muslims in Britain. It's not going to be possible for those 6 million Muslims in France. Economic situation for majority of those Muslims in France would not enable them, allow them really to leave, even if they wanted to leave, because of just the sheer amount of money that's required to move to somewhere like Turkey. You need to have some capital behind you, I suppose. So,
Or a job, to be fair.
So in the absence of that, how does a Muslim in this country still make it in these societies?
It's really tough. There's no quick fix, is there?
Yeah.
I mean, you live between here and Istanbul too, right?
Yes. Yeah.
I left, but people do have to be here, and they have elders, and the families I know who don't want to move usually don't want to move because they want to look after their parents and grandparents, which is a beautiful duty.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, these are our roots. This is our home. These are our villages, towns, and cities. Where do we go and start again? It's pretty scary. I don't think there's a quick fix to this, but I do think that we need to improve our Muslim schools. I think if we do a good enough job, that the non-Muslims with an ounce of ethical grounding will actually want to come and be in our schools. I don't know enough about the education here to say, can you fight, can you argue with the Department of Education about what children see now? And they're coming for homeschooling as well.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's very true. Can I turn to a broader question about how you perceive gender relations in Islam? There's a raging debate, and again, it's usually online, about what is the role of the men and women in the family? What's the role of men and women in society? And of course, there are some who have a very liberal interpretation and some who have an interpretation which makes it impossible for those families to function. But I'm just talking about, I want to know about, the average, how do normal Muslims view this? Let's first consider the idea of patriarchy, which is, of course, a buzzword in the West. Can we describe the Islamic faith to be a patriarchal faith because of the way Islam views the father as the authority figure in the family and the responsible person and the person who has to provide, for the maintenance of the entire household? That, for me, sounds like a very patriarchal idea, but the connotations attached to patriarchy, of course, are very negative. So how would you navigate that term, patriarchy?
I think our idea of patriarchy really culturally goes back to the Victorians, because the man in certainly middle class and upper class society had absolute dominion over the women.
Right. Property rights.
Property,
everything.
Inheritance. Right. You married, you went from your father's house to your husband's house, and you could carry none of that wealth with
wow.
you.
Yeah.
Right? And if your father died and you inherited a great amount of land, it was your husband's, and he could do with it what he liked. Spend right. it, drink it, give it away.
Yeah.
And so that is a terrifying prospect. And I think really as Westerners, as Europeans, as British people, we're traumatized by that. The women, we're traumatized by this legacy. We're traumatized by the fact that there was no protection from the heavy drinking, from the beatings, that we couldn't escape because we had no money. And this is not the Islamic, this is not the Muslim experience. Mm. Look at Khadija radiallahu anha. She had inherited wealth from husbands. She had built an empire that she could keep after marriage. Mm. We have always had this. And yet we're supposed to look at Islam through the lens of Victorian patriarchy and superimpose then feminism on top of it. Reject all of that. Mm. We don't want anything to do with that.
We start again. We start with a blank
again.
Sheet.
So yeah. Then yeah. And also, where is the... Does Allah Ta'ala say this is a patriarchal religion, women are lesser? No. These interpretations were never what was understood.
Right.
You know, the woman is a cover for the man is a cover for the woman. Yeah. The man has one over on the woman, but what does that mean? What does it mean? He's got duties that are really, really heavy and beautiful. Mm. And actually, you know, me and my husband speak about this a lot because he's studied, alhamdulillah, he's got ijaza in fiqh. And
yes.
It's a man thrives with the weight of caring for people. Mm. And a woman thrives with that care being lifted and being looked after. No point is one pressuring or destroying or saying to the other change.
Right.
But growing together and thriving.
Yeah.
You know, I want to say to my young sisters, you're talking to someone who for 30 years as an adult lived the ultimate in feminism. Mm. I've worked since I was 16. I was hugely successful at the age of 30. I earned more than my husband. No one could tell me what to do. I was entirely liberated from any man. Mm-hmm. And what did that look like? Well, I'm telling you, you have your time of the month, you're tired. There's nobody showing you sympathy because, hey, I don't need your sympathy. If you said I don't need your sympathy 100 times, don't expect on day 101 to go, I'm in pain. Well, you said you didn't need sympathy, right? I carried my own bags. When I was pregnant, no man was carrying my bags. I had some really horrible experiences during pregnancy. I remember once, and I hope you keep this in because it's really telling about vulnerable moments that women have, okay? Because we need to accept our vulnerability. I was 8 months pregnant. I was showing off how I could carry my 8 months pregnancy and still be at the Labour Party conference. And it was 1 o'clock in the morning because I wasn't going to go home early just because I'm pregnant. And I started to have really bad pains. I mean, like stabbing pains. And so I was sitting on a Brighton pavement in the rain at 1 a.m. waiting for a taxi. And the taxi came and two young men from Blair's government, by the way, jumped into the taxi. And I went, wait, I'm waiting as well. And they're like, yeah, whatever. And I said, but can't you let me go in? And then one of them said, he was 20 years old, why? I said, because I'm pregnant. He said, well, it's not my baby, is it? Is that really the society that we want? Is that really the liberty and egalitarian equality that we're fighting for? Don't be fooled. I want to give another example because this made me laugh. I was on an underground train a couple of years ago and I saw a young black sister and she was looking like she was absolutely going to faint. I don't know whether she was ill or just had been working hard. And she was exhausted standing up. And next to me was a young man and he looked Asian. I just love being an auntie. That's something else, by the way. You know, Islam gives you a status to grow into.
Yes.
I can be as annoying and bossy And people are like, oh, it's auntie, leave auntie alone. It's wonderful, you know, you have that space. Anyway,
yes.
The young man next to me, young Asian guy, and I said, excuse me, brother, are you Muslim? Mm. He said, yes, I am. I said, then get out of that chair and let the Muslim sister sit down. Mm. And he was like, oh, okay, auntie. Do you know what she did?
What?
No, I'm all right, thanks. I said, you're going to sit down and you're about to have a three-stop lecture from me about how to enable men to look after you. Mm. Yeah, because we're not enabling our men any longer to be the carers. And that makes them bitter and frigid and more likely to say, I don't want to care for you. You don't deserve it. You're this, you're that. Leading to these schisms,
yeah,
and illnesses. And I just wanted to end on that point of the patriarchy. Islam, Allah Ta'ala sees believers,
yes,
and cares about piety. That's very clear from all of the texts. There isn't a male-female divide. You know, it's not men in this line. Oh, yeah, you get fast-tracked to Jannah. Show me that tract. Show me where it says that. It doesn't. Alhamdulillah. You know, the patient ones, the sabareen, the kind ones, the good ones, the ones who give charity, the ones who pray to their Lord, the ones that's our parameters, not the patriarchy.
There's an interesting point you made there about the friction that exists in wider society and the spillover into the Muslim community. I've noticed, and again, this may be, and we don't have to talk about him in particular, but the Andrew Tate effect, where there is this extreme response to hyperfeminism, and a response is this machoism, where with it comes this attitude that all women are bad. I mean, I think it's maybe a response, may not be a response, but there is an associated feeling amongst women that all men are bad, all men are evil. Mm. And that doesn't lead to very good relations between men and women. We've noticed, and again, you know, you've been out of the country for a while, but we've noticed in this last year or two that the Andrew Tate type of ideas have started to develop currency amongst young men and young Muslim men. And some of it may be positive, you know, giving them, but a lot of it actually is an un-Islamic way of viewing women. I mean, how have you come across this? And it's a confusing world for young men as well as young women, I suspect.
Listen, be right on the cutting edge of it with a daughter at university. You have young men saying, I get to dominate you. I mean, it's like seven-year-olds going, I don't like boys. I don't like girls.
Yeah.
You know, I don't like you because you're less than me. And I don't like you because you smell. It's pathetic. And it really is damaging the relations between the genders for our young Muslims, subhanAllah. You know, you've got an environment where a young man can, and I've heard this twice recently, in two potential marriages, there were two engagements, and both times the young men said, I have the right to check your emails and your phone.
Wow, really?
Yeah. And the family of the young women went hell to the no, because that is psychologically controlling behavior.
Yes.
And it's unhealthy. But these sort of, you know, noises off, if you like, these surround sound, I'm not going to even name them.
Mm.
These people on social media, these men on social media who have their own toxic problems and their own, you know, lack of spirituality. It's a lack of spirituality from the brothers to look at themselves and to say, how am I being beautiful? How am I being kind? How am I going to bring kindness into this?
Chivalrous.
That's leadership.
Yeah.
That is leadership.
Yeah.
Being chivalrous is leadership. And on the other side, yes, we have a fractured and what's it when it's not frigid, it's easily breakable version of a female femininity where they're afraid of the men.
Mm.
And then that makes us more likely to run to the safety of the office, the safety of having our own money, the safety of a life without a family, because I'm afraid of you. And we all need to breach that gap. We all of us. You know, the learned people, the ones who are you know, role models or speakers, however you want to call us elders, we need to bridge that gap and say, come on, guys, speak to each other. Because I think it's hyper individualism
right.
is an issue here.
Wow. Right. So to explain that hyper-individualism, it's that it's about my rights and about my response, my obligation. And that's it. That's all that counts.
Yeah. We think so. A lot of the brothers, the young brothers, are saying feminism, and everything that a woman wants is now feminism. Mm. She's the kind of woman who wants two dresses, not one. Feminist. What are you talking about? Yeah. She's the kind of woman who would like to have her own keys to the door. Feminist. No, what? Everything is called feminist now.
Yes.
And it's such a derogatory term.
That's true. Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just bandied about for normative behaviours.
Jazakallah khair. I think that's interesting. I suspect there needs to be more effort, probably from Islamic scholars or Muslim role models, to address this subject in a more rational way, in a more sensible way, probably.
Sure.
I know Imam Dawood Walid has written a book on Islamic chivalry, Muslim chivalry,
nice.
And he gives classes to young men as to how they should, you know, how they should respond to women and what should be their response. And
brittle was the word I was thinking of. To my young sisters, I'd say, don't be brittle. Mm. Okay, if a young man says, can I take your chair, say, thank you so much. Yes, it doesn't make you weak. It makes you cared for. It makes you a part of that society. I'm a big one for going to events. And at the end, the sisters always want to gather the chairs. I'm like, nope, you don't move anything. Brothers, get in there. Let's use those muscles that you're buffing up at the gym. Yes. Come and do something useful. You know, we need to give each other spaces. And when I said hyper-individualism, what did I mean? I meant there's a selfishness. Mm. If you are a young sister and you want to go into marriage and you're like, but I'm not going to cook and I ain't going to do this. And well, what is the point of marriage? You just want a flat chair, basically, with somebody paying your bills. Yeah. No one's going to buy into that. It's not fair and it's not nice. Yeah. It's not kind. Just be kind to each other. Why can't people just be normal?
Can I ask you a couple of political questions? I know a lot of your book does discuss your politics prior to becoming Muslim and how you changed not only socially and changed in terms of your spiritual attitude, but also your political understanding. And the Iraq War is I think a key milestone in your political journey, and just how duplicitous maybe the British political elite were, and in particular the Labour Party were, in taking Britain to war. I mean, again, you're from someone who now lives a lot of the year outside of the country. Has any of that improved? Do you feel that British politics has moved on since that disastrous Iraq War decision?
Well, you know, this book really tracks a spiritual and a political journey of a person who wanted to have beliefs but not do anything about it.
Right.
And then was forced by, as many were, by the Iraq War to wake up. In 2003, when I went on that march, I was breastfeeding one baby, pushing another in a pram. It was -3 degrees. If people were there, they'll remember, snowing and sleeting. And I told my three-year-old, it's not meant to be fun. Kids like you are dying. Okay, which could sound kind of harsh on a three-year-old walking in the snow.
Yes.
But, you know, if you believe in something, you have to put yourself out there. Don't be an armchair anything. Yeah. And what I saw on that march was amazing. There were women from Middle England who told me, I've never been on a march before, you know, dear, but this isn't right what's happening. You know, shock and awe, is that what we're about now? My father fought in the war and it wasn't about killing civilians. All right. So we had this idea of decency. Yeah. And what the Iraq War did was it wrecked our version of ourselves as British people.
Right. This was before you became Muslim.
This was before.
Ah.
Yeah. And I actually, I met Yusuf Chambers because of my activity there.
Yeah.
And we...
He's the lawyer, Muslim lawyer, convert. Yes, sorry.
Continue. Yeah, yeah. And he invited me to give a speech at an event for Iraqi war widows and orphans. And I bring it up because that event was where the first time I'd really experienced segregation of the genders in my life.
Yes.
So I was speaking on the stage and then Yusuf said, and then I saw all the cool guys sitting over there and the sheikhs and Cat Stevens, Yusuf, Islam was there. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, I'll be sitting over there. And Yusuf went, no, no, the women are over here. And I went, I'm really like a sulky child. And I, being a thinking person by the grace of Allah, I thought to myself, oh my God, I think I'm a misogynist because I don't like women. I don't want to say, and not apart from that, all the racism thoughts that I was having, like, oh God, going to be talking about biryani and kids. These were all things that we can ignore or actually pick out in ourselves. But, yes. And Islam is a very reflective, mashallah, spiritual way of life. So, So I picked up on those. Anyway, I went to the table and there was the first niqabi I'd ever spoken to.
Right.
So she's sitting opposite the table and I thought, I'll just be nice and engage her, poor thing, a little bit about kitchen stuff. I said, so what do you do? And I fully expected to say, I've got seven kids and I'm a third wife. And she said, I'm studying civil engineering at the University of X, Y, and Z. I'm in my fourth year, I got a first in this and da-da-da-da. And I'm leading my class and I was like, oh, right. And she wiped the floor with me. Mm-hmm. Intellectually, she got the mop. She put me in there and she wiped the floor with me.
Right.
And I loved it because I thought, good on you. And what she said to me, coming right back and circling back to the beginning of our discussion, what does modesty mean to her? She said she used to be, when she first started university, to fit in, she was in a t-shirt and jeans. And she noticed the men looking at her. And when she got up, she knew there was an uptick in the scoring because people liked her presentation because she was pretty.
Mm.
And she said, then I started getting closer to my dean and I wanted to take away those triggers and protect myself for my Lord, my family. And now I have to work not twice as hard, exponentially hard in my presentations because I have nothing here.
Mm.
But my words are good enough for me to be the head of that class. I'm like, boy, I got it. I think that's the moment I got modesty. And that's the moment I started to like women.
Can I ask you about your book, your biography, your memoir, In Search of a Holy Land? I read a really fascinating section in the book about your experience. I mean, you were someone who was very much in favor of Tony Blair. Of course, he's a relative of yours. I mean, our viewers would know that he's married to your sister. And you were very much someone who was within the Labour mode, and you supported New Labour as the alternative to conservatism, which was, of course, horrid in the 1990s.
Oh, it's horrid now.
And it's still horrid. Yeah. That's true. That's very true. But then there was a change in your view of Labour. And the Iraq War, of course, as you've just discussed, comes into that. But, I found it a fascinating read. In a way, it allowed me to understand how someone who was a non-Muslim viewed those years. Because from a Muslim perspective, I saw it very much as a war on terror. This is a prime minister who's getting close to Bush. And, it's amazing. Every day there was something on TV about Muslims. And every other day, Tony Blair was announcing an anti-terror law. And, I just felt that Muslims were under siege during that period. So it was fascinating to see from your perspective, but just from a broader sense. I mean, what lay behind? Why did you write this book, your memoir?
I wrote this for somebody like myself in my 20s who got a sense that this isn't it. This table, this mug, this world isn't it. The material world, that there's something more out there, but couldn't put my finger on it. And many of the people that we meet, they're exploring Buddhism and they're going through the tick boxes. Right. Even veganism is almost like a religious cult now. You're cleansing your body to get closer to some amorphous being, right? But what is the access point to a spirituality that leads to God? I wanted to give that access point and also to run through the differences in the culture, the things that have been happening over the last 25 years, who were we and who are we now? And there's so much in there as well about traveling to Muslim lands and to accepting my own innate prejudices as well. I hope I've done it in a humorous way. I think people do tell me that, yes, I laughed my way through it and I cried my way through it. Yeah. But that honesty about what I thought about Muslims, then you meet them, and then you suddenly find yourself in a mosque waking up going, oh my God, God is Allah. And this guy, Muhammad, I kind of think he's the last prophet. What do you do with that? Mm. And so it takes us on that journey. And I really wanted to do that for people like me in my 20s. But I think more than ever, my readers are Muslims. Young Muslims asking themselves, I don't know why I don't know why I'm Muslim. Mm. I'm Muslim by heritage, but I don't know how to ask the questions. And I don't know how to come over this hump if I can make it in modernity as a Muslim. Mm. It answers those questions, inshallah, in one way, from a Western perspective to an Eastern perspective, from a Christian to a Muslim.
Can I ask you one last question about Palestine? Now, you've been a advocate for Palestinian rights for a very long time. And, you know, it's often quite perplexing to just see how Israel is treated in a very double, you know, it's become now common to say that there is a hypocrisy, there's double standards. And Israel is treated in a completely different way than any other country in the world. It can get away with anything, really, and there will not be a uproar in the British press or in the American press or the European press. How do you understand this indefensible support for Israel in the West?
I don't think they're getting it all their own way anymore.
Right. It's changing, isn't it?
Since, you know, just in the little time span when I've been an observer, and the other good thing, by the way, much better thing, is that the Palestinians now have their own voice. Social media has allowed people like me to step back. You know, you don't need my voice now. Mm. Maybe you never did. Maybe it was white savior. Wallahu alam. I just, you know, we saw something and we wanted to reflect upon it with the world. Yeah. So there's a Palestinian voices now of pain, of brilliance, of cleverness, of resistance, and they're being heard. So that's number one. And the second thing is, I think the exceptionalism is falling apart. Alhamdulillah, studies have shown that young Christians in America, which is really Israel's capital state of support, are now more likely to support the Palestinian cause than be Zionists. And that's huge. I think a couple of weeks ago in Australia, is it the government who said they're going to be referring to the they're not going to be calling it the occupied West Bank, they're going to be calling it Palestine now? That, for the Zionists, is like the stab in the heart. So yes, there is still political exceptionalism. And unfortunately, it looks going to take many more deaths and much more pain, probably, for that to change. But it is changing. Alhamdulillah. You know, never give up. Never give up. Allah sees all. They want to destroy Allah. So, Allah, you know, Allah is with the believers. And the world is waking up. So I actually feel much more positive than I did at the start of my personal experience with this question in 2005.
Sister Lauren Booth, Jazakallah khair for your time today. It's been fascinating.
Rafiq, absolute pleasure.
Please remember to subscribe to our social media and YouTube channels and head over to our website, thinkinmuslim.com, to sign up to my weekly newsletter. Jazakallah khair.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.